accession number 27083, reel 4.
Water over your shoulders, went for her and hoped to get away with it.
Well, you hoped to get away with it. But of course, if you were caught, you were beaten. And that was that. You then went back to the dormitory and you flung on your clothes. And at some point, the bell was rung and you had to kneel and say your prayers.
In the morning?
In the morning, yes. Your personal prayers. And I forget how long that lasted, but it was a good half minute, I should think. And that was the best opportunity for getting hold of your boots and putting them on and doing up such buttons as you hadn't already done up and so forth. And then at the end of that whatever half minute, you had to stand up. And shortly after that, you had to clear the dormitory, picking up any bits and pieces that you hadn't got on your body en route, and so forth. Now that sounds rather brutal, but in fact it was an invaluable bit of learning, because the number of occasions when you had to change very quickly or dress very quickly were legion later on. So that was good stuff. I come back now to the various other bits and pieces, and I'll start with the academic work. The quality of it was limited, in my view. For example, you didn't do any Latin. Okay, that's understandable in a way, because you couldn't do everything. History was entirely confined to naval history. And further, it was confined to a particular author of naval history. And I'm sure he's a very distinguished chap. I never met him. But his name was Professor Geoffrey Callender. Quite a well-known historian, I think, certainly a naval surgeon, because of what was rammed down our throats. And he wrote a thing called Sea Kings of Britain. And it was pretty flowery stuff. And one clause I well recall was, a sail in the west, 'twas hawk. And then a couple of lines further down, and blood running in the scuppers. But the point of my criticism is that you stopped any form of history, and you really only did naval history, and you stopped even that shortly before the Boer War. Because the Boer War, which might have taught you something, and the Great War, which would certainly have taught you a lot, were regarded as too recent. Now, you could go to the library, and I did, and draw Julian Corbett's History of World War I and so forth, which was alive and was fascinating and meant something, and who formed opinions of who did well and who did not so well at once. But you didn't get that out of the Sea Kings of Britain. And there were lots of diagrams with lots of little lozenges representing ships, all in serried rank, as if anybody really knew, and so on. So that was bad, and it was a gobstopper. Any enthusiasm that you might have developed was killed at birth.
This does seem odd, because the standard of entry you're suggesting is quite high. It's right, above, yeah, common entrance, and yet, yeah, as soon as you get there, the standard of tuition sounds to be lower than the worst third-rate public school.
Yes. I'm afraid that's English. Various people taught you a certain amount of English. You had to learn bits of poetry. Well, I'd actually been turned on at my prep school to like poetry, other than Shakespeare, which was rammed down my throat too early, and I've hated him ever since. But that's another matter. But provided it was it rhymed, I would take any bit of verse, and I could concoct a bit of verse at the drop of a hat, and so on. But it was made boring. It was tedious, and it was boring. And ironically, the worst example, really, as I've already mentioned, was seamanship, so-called. That was dreadful. Now, another thing which was pretty unfortunate and pretty basic was the medical facilities. We had our own hospital. We had a surgeon commander and a couple of young doctors. And we had a so-called resident matron, I suppose, who dominated the sick bay, where you went for a purge or to have a boil slit or whatever. And she was adept at squeezing boils. But broadly speaking, you were inculcated with it wasn't exactly fear so much as a dread of having to go anywhere near the medical facilities. You had a belly muster for the first 3 weeks of every term, and this occurred after lunch, and you lined up in your dormitory, and you pulled up your shirt and held it up to see if you had a rash. Very sensible, really. But if you did have a rash, as I did from time to time, you know, I got German measles, I think, or something, you did your utmost to conceal it, and as often as not got away with it. So it was a bit crude. Now, what I'm really saying is that you went to the sick bay if you were at last gasp. And there was you were either sent to hospital, our own hospital, or else you were awarded what was known as a detained sick bay, DSB. I went once. I had a sore throat, a stinking cold, and I felt awful. And I was awarded DSB. And I didn't know where to go. And nobody told me. So I walked up to the hospital, where there was a big bay window over the main entrance, and you could see people playing snooker, the convalescents. And I walked in to join them. And not long afterwards, I was rumbled, as it were, by one of the sisters. I said, I'm sorry, I think I've come to the wrong place. And she rather typically said, oh, well, I better take your temperature. Which she did, and they put me to bed. And they had a standard way of informing your parents if you were put on the sick list. And it said, this is to inform you that cadet so-and-so had been admitted to hospital suffering from, and the rest was filled in. And my parents got a chit saying, suffering from a slight cold. And 36 hours later, they got a second chit saying, suffering from pneumonia. And I had pneumonia, which is why I wasn't feeling very well. And I was in hospital for, I forget what, 3 weeks or so, I suppose. And that entirely due to my parents, because they had no opinion for naval medical proficiency whatsoever, and with absolute justification. They yanked me out of hospital, and I was taken home, not very far away as it was, in an ambulance, and put to bed at home, where I then developed pleurisy, so that sort of thing. My point being, the medical facilities were pretty basic. I think it was 1938, King George VI and Queen Elizabeth and the two princesses visited the college, and I was a member of the Royal Guard, which was provided by my house, which was the Grenville House, and that was a great event, of course. And I turn now to the officers and the general routine. When the war came, the house officers, who I think had been probably fairly carefully chosen prior to the war, I'd like to hope so, that as soon as the war came, they were all whisked off to sea, and they were replaced by dugouts, retired officers, who in some cases were very retired indeed, and no way were they very carefully selected, I don't think. Now, one's got to be careful about overgeneralizing. And there was one chap, Monkey Seller, who'd retired in the middle 30s, I think, as lieutenant commander, who was a very good games player. He became a stockbroker, and he would undoubtedly have gone a long way, but he chose to leave the Navy. I don't know why. He was professional. He knew his stuff. He was full of enthusiasm. He had good leadership qualities, and so forth. He and the captain would semaphore to each other across the length of the cricket field. Now, this was impressive. There was some use for semaphore. We'd learnt semaphore, but we didn't know why, and so on. My man, who'd better be nameless, I suppose, walked as if he had a sort of spring under each heel. He was as thick as two planks. He didn't appear to know anything about anything. I remember him coming to the gunroom on one occasion and talking at us for 15, 20 minutes. It's quite a long time. And his message was, you've got to play cricket. Well, you either did play cricket or you didn't. And his exhortation didn't affect the price of fish, frankly. And he was just unprofessional. He was a bit of a joke, really. And the thing that was lacking was any form of what I would describe as inspirational leadership. That's what was lacking. And that's what I was yearning for and not getting. And I was, frankly, bored rigid. And then came...
May I ask, did you tell your father this?
No, because he was away. You see, he was away at sea.
And you didn't write to him and say that there were a frightful shower here at Dartmouth, did you know?
No, I didn't. Wouldn't have got me in a way, anyway, I don't think. Right. I mean, but then, for my first year or so, including the royal visit, the captain of the college was a great friend of my pa's. He was fine. But it was the academic staff. And once the war came, not till 1939, of course, then I wouldn't say anything about the house officers prior to that, because I think they were guys of metal. But they, how shall I put it, the rapport between your house officer and you was pretty minimal. Quite honestly. As to the headmaster, who was a huge man with a face like a bulldog, called Kempson, father of the worthy Rachel, I was there for one term short of 4 years, and I never exchanged a word with him. Never met him face to face. So don't ask me what he did. I think I've got some idea because of having dealings with Dartmouth later on with different headmasters. But there's something wrong about that, I think. Well, then, the war now on, and it caught everybody a bit short.
Did it really? It wasn't anticipated? After Munich, people didn't think to themselves,
well,
oh, we've only got a short period.
I don't think down in Darkest Devon they did, no, not really. And they, the authorities, provided us with, I forget what it was, two or three quadruple 0.5 machine guns for air defense. And we, the cadets of the ninth term, had to man them. The ninth term was selected because they were the senior term, which was supposedly not mugging up for its exams. Of course, the training cruiser could not continue as such because of the war, and anyway she was required for other things. And so your final two terms, your 10th and 11th terms, you were taught what were termed special subjects at Dartmouth as an addition. And this was in lieu of the your time in the training cruiser, which you were not now going to get. And these were things like a smattering of gunnery and torpedo and pilotage as opposed to astro-navigation and fleet maneuvers as opposed to semaphore or Morse and so on. I'll finish that bit off. I suddenly realized overnight that this is what I'd been desperately searching for and not getting. And I worked very hard at those subjects, and I scooped the special subject prize at the end of my 11th term, and that was that. But to go back, the ninth term manned these machine guns. And we thought we were hell's own toughies. You know, we wore oil skins, we wrapped towels around our necks, we strutted up and down, we never saw an aircraft. We'd never have hit one in any case, because these were the control of this funny little mountain. You had a trainer in the lateral plane one side and a layer in the vertical plane the other side. You were jolly lucky if they coordinated on the same target at the same time and so forth. But as a result, we didn't do very much instruction, and that was an enormous release and relief. And that was that. I was never a cadet captain. By this time, I, as I said, apart from the special subject, I had become bored. I think not perhaps particularly well behaved, and so on. Not that I got into much trouble, but there it was. I looked with derision at some of the cadet captains, including out of my own term, that were made cadet captains, and so forth. And it was quite interesting. We had, during my second term at the college, my house officer was a man called McKendrick, Wally McKendrick, who was a professional. He knew a lot about a lot. He'd gone up a term, which was quite exceptional in his time. And at the time, unjustifiably as it turned out, but at the time we all thought he was a really rather nasty bit of work. He was brusque. There was no rapport, there was nothing at all. And then we were split up into our various houses, and at about that time, he went sick. and he had a brain tumour. And they lifted the back of his head off and fiddled about inside. And it was round about my 9th, 10th term, he came back as my house officer. We got rid of the other fellow, who was utterly useless. And this poor man, who'd obviously fought very hard, insisted on coming back to active service before he was ready to do so. And you'd see him walking up the main corridor on two sticks, tacking from side to side, head absolutely shaven, and so forth. But he was a different person. And he very quickly started to just to talk to us, to tell us things, teach us, if you like, that's the effect, about life in a ship at sea. And he would give, I suppose, the phraseology would have said, dog watch lectures, voluntary lectures, but they weren't really lectures. And he was a great man, and he was a totally different personality, because he'd been sickening before, and that's why it was unkind to say those things about him. And he wrote to me, which was surprising and unusual, he wrote to me after I left the college, before I went to sea, and that was only over a period of a couple of weeks or so, and congratulated me on taking the special subject prize, and on how I had taken not being made a cadet captain, which is an interesting comment, and surprised me, because, as I say, I rather despise some of the qualities of cadet captains that had been made. Now, I'm very nearly there on Dartmouth. They had, remarkably, when the war came, and you were not going, therefore, to the training cruiser on leaving Dartmouth, they had a scheme whereby, provided you weren't obviously stupid about it, because you couldn't go to a destroyer or a submarine, but virtually any other sort of ship, you asked to go to that named ship, and you went to it, which was remarkable.
You were given the option.
You were given the option. And it worked. Astonishing. Here we were. I think by then we'd lost two or three out of my term, so we were, give or take, we were 50. And we were all appointed to the ships that we'd asked for. So, knowing that this was the form, you formed a team of your chums and said, well, let's go to so-and-so. And my chums and I said, right, let's go to a cruiser, a new cruiser, not quite so stuffy as a battleship, and new and everything up to date and all that stuff. And we opted to go to the Fiji, a colony class 6-inch cruiser. And that was that. And in August 40, my father was Director of Naval Ordnance, then stationed in Bath, and he took me fishing from home one evening, and in the course of the evening he asked me where I wanted to go when I left the college. I then had one term to do. And because I had settled for the Fiji with my chums, I tried to bob him off and said, all right, Dad, no, don't bother, it's all fixed, thank you. And he was a bit brusque with me and said, well, that doesn't answer the question. And I said, well, I and my chums are going to the Fiji. Oh, he said. And I can remember his exact words. More better, I think, to get a thicker roof over your head before the next summer months. And I remonstrated, oh, come on, Dad, lay off. It's all fixed. Leave it to me. And I was appointed to the Prince of Wales. So that meant a switch of, and I got to know mainly public school people, who by then, of course, had joined up because of no training cruiser. gave to the Prince of Wales. And that was that.
What was your father's reasoning? Why did he want you to go not to a small six-inch cruiser, but to...
He wanted something with a thicker armoured deck before the bombs started falling during the daylight hours the next summer. Just that. Well then, I'm skipping slightly. He came home unexpectedly from Bath one Saturday evening, and we were all in the dining room having tea, and nobody expected him. It was a Saturday evening. And he came in, and Mum turned to him and said, I'm delighted to see you, but we weren't really expecting him. And he said, didn't you get my letter? No, she hadn't got his letter. Oh, he said, I'm off to sea. And her face fell. And I was really astonishingly ignorant about things like the sort of ship that my father would go to in command at his seniority, and I wasn't too sure of that either, and so on. I mean, I just didn't. But I had an immediate and strong gut feel that he'd be going to the Prince of Wales. Well, shortly afterwards, he came on a few days' leave over Christmas. And at about that time, the Germans bombed Birkenhead, where Prince of Wales was sitting out. Didn't do much damage to her, but did a bit, largely superficial. And anyway, she didn't want the gunroom then. And by the time she did, was ready to receive the gunroom, he had indeed taken over command. So I was switched to another ship, and I'll come to that later. So, to try and sum up on Dartmouth, I would freely admit, and I'm grateful for, it taught me four things. It taught me discipline, it taught me tidiness, it taught me how to dress and change quickly, which became invaluable later on, and it taught me a certain intolerance for the mediocre. That's my view of it. Some people would say, well, you don't want to be taught intolerance. But if you just take things as they are, too much for granted, I don't think that's healthy. And I will, because of, I've already mentioned a number of strictures, and that's how I learned a certain level of intolerance, I think. Can we stop, may?
Yes.